This is Caitlin Martin recording an interview with Lieutenant Colonel Berzowski on November 10th, 2006. So I'm just going to start by asking you your date of birth.
The 19th of February, 1929.
Perfect. And so how old does that make you during the FLQ crisis? About?
Okay. It was 1970, okay. I was about 41, I guess.
Perfect. And did you know about the FLQ prior to your deployment in Montreal?
Yes, from newspapers primarily, because there had been a number of FLQ-type activities that went on for a stretch of about 3 years in Quebec. Bombs in mailboxes, bombing armories, and of course, being in the military, things like bombing armories and breaking into the locker rooms where weapons were stored were of direct interest to anybody in uniform in the Army, particularly. Central Command, where I was in Ontario, so we were aware of all these underground activities that were building up over a period of about 3 years leading to the FLQ crisis.
Okay, and so had there been mention of military intervention prior to the FLQ crisis?
Not directly. But because at that, over that period of time, I was in Camp Borden, Ontario, training our militia artillery units from Ontario, six different regiments, and I was in a special headquarters where we were training those six units how to do live firing with their 105 howitzers. And it was a specialized sort of thing, and we knew what was going on, but we had little connection with the province of Quebec, other than the fact that the Army Command Headquarters was located in Saint-Hubert, Quebec, which was, of course, our Army Headquarters as well. So we were out on the fringe, on the periphery. We weren't really dealing with terrorists. But we did have to, over a period of time, as this grew, we had to increase security of our armories and the quartermaster stores where we kept rifles, uniforms, and our ammunition magazines had to have increased security because, of course, there's no wall at the border, these people could cross back and forth. So there was an increase in security, but it was on the periphery.
Okay. And where were you when the War Measures Act was declared?
I was the command duty officer in the command center of Mobile Command Headquarters that night, that day. I was in the hot seat when it happened. And it was my first day on ever as the command operations duty officer in the command center, after having just arrived in the headquarters 2 weeks prior to the War Measures Act being declared.
Did you think the element of surprise was important when the War Measures Act was declared?
No, absolutely not.
Why not?
Because several days before, upon the request of the provincial government, the Quebec government, through Mobile Command Headquarters, to the Defense Headquarters in Ottawa, we deployed troops in aid of the civil power in Quebec to help provide security at key installations because the civilian police force in Quebec, the Sûreté de Québec and the Montreal City Police Force and the outlying police forces had been guarding power stations, telephone, central exchanges, all the vital areas to the communities, and the police were exhausted. And so the, through the provincial government, the Attorney General, they requested army assistance under existing laws and regulations to have the army deployed in aid of the civil power.
Okay, and how did the public initially respond when they saw the soldiers marching in the streets?
Well, first of all, the soldiers weren't marching in the streets in that sense. They just quietly moved into key locations and relieved the policemen that had been on duty, and suddenly people saw, in fact, even the one that appeared on TV most often was the main entrance into the City of Montreal police station. Suddenly, soldiers were guarding the police station. And that would appear, the police would be bringing in someone that they had arrested, and the cameras would be there, and there was always a soldier with a rifle and a helmet in the background. So the public was becoming accustomed to seeing military people over a period of a few days of this aid of the civil power.
Okay.
And in conjunction with that, of course, there was a lot of military movement as we kept moving units, primarily from Valcartier, Quebec, the brigade group that was located in the province of Quebec. We gradually, unit by unit, realizing something big might be on the horizon, we created exercises, field training exercises, where these units would move away from Valcartier, closer and closer to Montreal. And when we suddenly needed a unit or some soldiers for one of these guard purposes, they were camped out in the vicinity, and we just went to the brigade headquarters, which was deployed forward adjacent to Mobile Command Headquarters, and we would pass on the requirement to them, and then the brigade commander, a brigadier general, would issue the orders to his units to deploy the troops.
Okay,
so this was not a surprise, you know.
Okay, but the citizens of Montreal were in support of the military coming in.
By and large, the only people who disagreed, besides René Lévesque, who was running the party in charge of separatism, and the FLQ people issuing manifestos to the public, which some of the people in Quebec, of course, it was like religion to them, but in the Montreal area, in this large capitalistic center, with at that time probably the stock exchange in Montreal was as big and important as the one in Toronto at that time. So it was a very major business community, and it, in fact, was Canada's first major business community with the Hudson's Bay Company and so on. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't any, in fact, my neighbors, French-Canadian family on one side, a pharmacist, in St. Bruno, Quebec, where we lived. Looking out to the street on the left-hand side was a pharmacist who was a native-born Quebecer. On the right-hand side was a service station owner who was of Italian background, a large Italian community in Quebec. And the two of them, their wives, said to my wife, "Sure glad your husband is here, because I wore a uniform. They felt safe."
Wow, okay. That's good to know.
And one day I apprised them of the fact, after it was all over, that all I really had to defend anybody was my dress sword.
Okay. How many troops were sent in to Montreal?
In total? I will have to come up with a guess here, because there were two operations in progress. Well, I guess you're not at the War Measures Act declaration at this stage, but we had two different operations in progress. In the Montreal area, we had Operation Essay, and in the Ottawa area, we had Operation Ginger. And we had a brigade committed to the Ottawa area, providing security to all the federal government buildings and to the key players in government and members of parliament for fear that they could be kidnapped, as Mr. Cross had been kidnapped a week or two before. So in total, between the two operations, eventually, we had over 6,000 troops deployed in the Montreal area and in the Ottawa area. But the Montreal area, my sense of it is that about two-thirds of the troops were working in around Montreal and Quebec City through the Quebec area, and about a third of the troops who had been brought in from all over Canada eventually were deployed in the Ottawa area. And the key player in Ottawa was the brigade group from Camp Petawawa. And the brigade commander from Petawawa was doing a similar job in Ottawa to the job being done by the brigade commander from Valcarce, who was sitting on Montreal's doorstep and actually giving the direct orders to the troops, carrying out a lot of reconnaissance exercises, hoping to stumble across an FLQ camp or two, which no one really did.
How big was your unit?
A unit? The basic unit.
That you served in. How big was your unit?
Oh, I was in the headquarters.
Okay.
I was in the operations branch,
which is
Mobile Command Headquarters, which was the commander, the command structure. The commander of the army was the commander of Mobile Command, who was a lieutenant general, Lieutenant General Turkle. And he had a full staff of two deputy major generals, one an Air Force major general, because we also owned an air group. The number 10 tactical air group was headquarters alongside of us. And staff, the headquarters staff, the major staff was Army. I would say there were probably 500 or 600 people total on the headquarters staff, and they would go down in rank. The commander, who was a lieutenant general, equivalent to a 3-star, as a lot of people like to say. And we had a major general. We must have had half a dozen brigadier generals. We must have had 24 full colonels. Lots of 20 or 30 lieutenant colonels, and lots of majors, which I was at that time as well.
Okay.
Now, of course, the brigade that was operating in Ottawa was part of Mobile Command. You know, I'm describing the headquarters because we had the Sankyum Groupement, the 5th Brigade Group from Valcarce, that was located in the Montreal area. And we had the brigade group from Petawawa deployed in around Ottawa. And then we had assorted other troops brought into the Montreal area and throughout Quebec. For example, overnight almost, we brought the Airborne Regiment from Edmonton to Montreal for special operations. And a brigade group usually amounts to about 3,500 people. It consists of 3 infantry battalions of 900 soldiers per battalion, commanded by a lieutenant colonel.
Okay.
And an artillery regiment of about 650 gunners, commanded by a lieutenant colonel, and usually 24 guns. I don't think they had too much artillery with them. They just used the gunners as if they were infantry. In fact, a friend of mine who was the CO of the 2nd Royal Canadian Horse Artillery from Petawawa, he used his regiment to actually provide the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week security guard around Parliament Hill. And that unit, unfortunately, suffered the only fatality in this operation.
And what was that?
Well, a new shift came on. They were driven up in a 2.5-ton truck. And this is secondhand information, but the CEO personally related this to me. They were changing the guard. A new truck rolled up with relief for a section of seven or eight soldiers, gunners who were in a specific area. And as they jumped out over the tailgate of the 2.5-ton truck, one of the bombardiers, that's a corporal in the artillery, is called a bombardier. He jumped out of the 2.5-ton truck with a Sten machine gun slung over his shoulder. And when he hit the ground, the machine gun slipped off his shoulder, the butt hit the pavement, and fired the bullet that was in the Sten gun, which was a World War II relic. We finally got rid of him a year or two later, but unfortunately that bullet struck him in the back of the head and killed him.
So once the War Measures Act had been declared, the FLQ crisis was all over the city. What did your duties include?
Okay, let me back up. We knew it was happening, and I went into the operations center at 8 o'clock in the morning to take over in the command center, and it was my first time in there, because I'd only arrived a couple of weeks before in the headquarters, and when my turn came up, I was in the duty roster before I reported in. They weren't missing a bet. And I reported in as to relieve the off-going operations officer in the command center, FMC, the Force Mobile Command Center, from which we controlled the entire army across Canada. And part of the army, of course, was in Germany at that time. We still had an army brigade group in Germany. So while we provided people for Germany, they were our responsibility to train, equip, and so on. But once they proceeded overseas, they became part of NATO, and then we didn't have any command responsibility for them. So they didn't appear on our tally boards in the command center where we were running this operation. But our own troops were there. And I reported in at 8 o'clock in the morning, which is the normal handover, took over a little bit of paraphernalia, the most important thing at this stage, because we had troops being moved and we were ordering troops to move, and you had to have an authentication code, because most of the orders were being issued by telephone or by radio. And from command headquarters, we went down to subordinate headquarters, like brigade, or I had occasion to call Trenton, which was the air traffic operations center in Trenton, with respect to controlling aircraft, that sort of thing. And the authentication code, a very secret code, but it was a system where when you came on the air and identified yourself and provided a request or issued an order, the recipient at the other end would immediately respond with authenticate, and he would give you a number of letters and numbers, alphanumeric code, usually half a dozen or eight, I believe, because I haven't used one for many years now. And you then went to that code, and by going to this chart that you had for the code, you could identify the sector of the code from which he was reading. In other words, sort of the page number, if you will. And then the other numbers put you into a box on that page. And you then had to read back to him the corresponding coded numbers in that box. And if it was the same as his box, then he knew you were authentic, and we carried on business. And this was very important, because we were moving people from all over Canada. Yeah, as the buildup came, and we realized that the War Measures Act would be declared. And when we really started getting serious about this was when the provincial government, the Premier of Quebec, submitted a request to the Prime Minister of Canada that the police in Quebec retired, that we'd had two kidnappings, that terrorist threat wasn't abating, and the situation was such that he recommended implementation of the War Measures Act. And Mr. Bourassa, the Premier, did that the day before. And then the Prime Minister issued a warning that things were becoming serious and the War Measures Act may be invoked. And eventually, early that evening, the 15th of October, the Prime Minister came on and made a public statement on TV, radio. And we were listening to this in the command center. We were listening to this and realized where we were going. So obviously various actions were being taken. And one of the first ones I took, as things started building up in the command center, I phoned my boss, the senior staff officer, Lieutenant Colonel, and I said, I think, sir, you should come in. Lieutenant Colonel Jack Vance later went on to become Lieutenant General and Vice Chief of the Defense Staff a few years later. So he came in and he took over the chair from me in the command center, looking out over the big table and support staff and all the big screens and boards with numbers and maps with distribution of troops in different sites. So he took over the chair. And I carried on as one of the helpers in the area, and I did a lot of things, phoning from my little inner office, provided a quiet area when you had to phone instructions to people. It was nice to do it in a small office rather than doing it at the big table then. And as the situation built up, by about 8 o'clock that evening, Lieutenant General Gilles Turkle, the commander of Mobile Command, was called in, and he took over that same chair at the head of the table. And there we stayed in that situation. And about midnight, he received a phone call from the acting chief of the defense staff in Ottawa, Lieutenant General Mike Dare, because the chief of the defense staff was away on annual leave in Bermuda or the Bahamas, someplace down there. He'd gone off on annual leave, and then all this broke loose. So the deputy, or the vice chief of the defense staff, Lieutenant General Dare, was running National Defense Headquarters. And he called General Turkle. Spoke to him for a minute, and General Turkle said, "Gentlemen, I want everybody to hear this. Sigs, put this telephone call on the loudspeaker." And General Dara then, he heard this, of course, and he came on and said, "Gilles, this is Mike Dara in Ottawa. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court has just signed the War Measures Act. You may now deploy your troops." Gilles said, "Done." And away we went. And that was about midnight.
So what did you do then after the War Measures Act?
One of the first things I had to do was go into my quiet little room with an Air Force Brigadier General, call the Air Traffic Control Center in Trenton, Ontario, from which they controlled all aircraft that were flying all over the world. And after going through the authentication code drill, I gave them the order, and that was about 0200 in the morning, to redirect two Hercules aircraft, no, not Hercules, sorry, there were two Yukons at that time, two Yukon aircraft to be redirected from over the United States where they were in flight and redirect them to Edmonton to pick up the Canadian Airborne Regiment in Edmonton and bring them to Montreal by Montreal time noon hour.
Wow.
And into St. Hubert Airport. Now, quite conveniently, the Canadian Airborne Regiment had had a bug-out, quote-unquote, bug-out exercise in Edmonton, anticipating that they would be called at some time or other. The CO, the commander of the Airborne Regiment, had ordered an evening exercise where all the troops had to come in from work, from home, so on, with their gear and so on, in case they had to bug out or go somewhere. And they had gone through this exercise where, when everybody checked in, the camp was locked down, a normal drill, so that people can't leave and people, strangers, can't come in once you've got everybody there with their equipment and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And they went through this whole process, checked the people out and so on, and then they laid on, it was in Edmonton, it was about, what would have been, 2 hours difference. So it was around working up to midnight. And they had some soup and coffee and cocoa on for the troops after the exercise before they were to go home. But they never did go home because they received our message, stand by for the aircraft. And the camp was locked down. The Airborne Regiment got aboard the aircraft as soon as they had refueled in Edmonton and made a beeline for Montreal, landing at St. Hubert Airport around noon hour on the 16th. And it wasn't until 3 days later that the dependents, the wives in Edmonton, had any idea of where the Airborne Regiment had disappeared to.
Wow.
One of the wives was watching the TV news, and there were some soldiers guarding areas and so on, and suddenly she said, "There's my husband!"
Mm.
And that's how they found out where the regiment had gone to.
Wow. Okay.
And that story I got from the second in command of the Airborne Regiment. He passed that on to me later on. And of course, I just continued on with a regular shift in the command post. But we ran into some internal problems when it came time to relieve me, normally at 8 o'clock in the morning, after 24 hours on duty. My relief was a young Air Force captain who had never been involved in any kind of operations. In fact, he was an aerospace engineer. And in the past, this had just been a case of answering some telephones and asking a sergeant what to do. But here we were in a real full-fledged major operation. So I said, go on up to the duty officer's room and I'll hand over to you. I tried to explain the authentication code system and how it worked, and he'd never encountered this before in his life. And I don't think he'd really had much or any staff training or done any type of field operation. He was kind of a full-time student, I guess, up to this point. And I wasn't succeeding in explaining how this functioned. So I said, well, look, let's just give that a rest for a few minutes, and here we'll complete the rest of the handover. I opened my desk drawer, which was about to become his desk drawer, and pulled out a receipt form, plunked it down, and pulled out a 9mm pistol, and plunked it down, and a box of bullets, and plunked it down, and said, here, sign for the pistol and 50 rounds of ammunition. And he jumped back, and he said, I've never touched one of those in my life, and I'm not going to touch one now.
Wow.
And I said, well, what do you mean? Haven't you done the normal basic training where you have to fire the rifle and the pistol and the machine gun? No, I've never done any of that. Of course, he's Air Force. He's not Army. You see, quite different in the training. And I said, and then he said, why do you have that pistol?
And I said, because if the terrorists break down the front door of this building to get into the op center, you become the last line of defense. Well, he blanched. And I said, tell you what, you better go back to your office and someone will call you later. I went down into the command center, and my boss was sitting in the chair. And this was now, by this time, it was, must have been about 10 o'clock in the morning, because a lot of things were going on, and I couldn't stop. And I'll do some backtracking on accounting for that time in a minute. But I went in and said to the senior staff officer, Colonel Jack Vance, I said, sir, we've got a problem. My relief has never handled a pistol. He knows nothing about staff procedures. He's an Air Force, a young Air Force captain that's had no staff training. And he, in all fairness, he can't work in here. So the boss said, okay, well, you carry on with what's happening, and I'll call some folks and see what, we've got to make some changes here. Well, the upshot of all this was that eventually it was agreed that only Army staff officers would work in the command center for the rest of the crisis. And all the Air Force junior officers, particularly, that were on the duty list were all relieved of duty, and only experienced people were allowed into the operation center. But to backtrack to about 9 o'clock in the morning of the second day, everybody's still there. No, I'd been on since 8 o'clock the previous morning, and of course I was up at 6 o'clock in the morning to have breakfast and come up to from St. Bruno over to St. Hubert to take over my job. And there were others in the same situation. But the commander called a briefing for 0900 in the operations center, and he wanted everybody, the whole command, the senior staff, the whole team. And it was rather fascinating. And the normal procedure for briefings, all Army briefings, you start out with the situation paragraph. And then the next paragraph is the enemy. And whether you're on the battlefield or doing this sort of thing, you follow the same headings. And so we all know exactly what's coming up. So when we got to we called it the threat paragraph. What's the threat? The enemy. The intelligence officer, a major, walked in, and all he had in his file were some newspaper clippings, but no hard intelligence, because while previous, the Prime Minister of Canada, one Mr. Elliott Trudeau, had issued an edict that the military, under no circumstances, would maintain files on any civilians in Canada. And so we had no intelligence pertaining to the criminal.
What
element.
About police information?
The police had their files, and when we went to them, and we worked very closely together, and they provided information to us. But at that stage of the game, we had no hard evidence on what was going on. In fact, as it turned out, I found out later, from people that were in Ottawa, that Ottawa had been provided more information through the RCMP, because the RCMP commissioner worked right with the forces commander and directly for the Prime Minister. They're all in that coterie. So there was an exchange of information there. But we, at the working level, weren't receiving very much of the police information at that point. The other thing that happened, I just want to bring that point up from the command briefing at 9 o'clock in the morning. But in the early morning, there was a call for additional assistance